This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time. Kate, this week we are talking confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Did you always know you would get published?
No, not at all. I did not. And I know that sometimes other people say, I knew you were going to get published, or I would say
I
the same thing to you.
I knew you were going to get published.
But I didn't. Having said that, I am generally optimistic that things will turn out the way they should. And I accept that that's because, you know, there's a lot of hard work, but also fate has been kind to me along the way as well. There's lots of things that have gone my way. And I wanted to jump in on the confidence talk because this is so present in my mind. I went to see Madeleine Daw and Zoe Foster-Blake at Melbourne Writers Festival. And I know you were disappointed. You were still away and you are a fan.
I'm obsessed with seeing Zoe Foster-Blake.
Obsessed. Extraordinary Routines.
Have you read any of her books?
No, I haven't actually. But I'm also a fan of Madeleine Daw and Extraordinary Routines. If people don't subscribe to that newsletter, it is a newsletter that I flag and keep at the top of my inbox.
Ah.
It's really very good. The routines of creatives. So literally what a day looks like in
Amazing.
The lives of all of these creatives. Very good. But they were in conversation and there were two things about confidence that really struck me with Zoe. The first was right at the start, she acknowledged luck and privilege as having played a role in where she's got to.
Yeah.
And that included, you know, her upbringing and her background, but also that she worked in magazines and the network that comes from working in magazines. But then she just really owned that she has also worked her ass off.
Yeah.
And she's really ambitious. So yeah. She started with this lovely kind of nod to yes, I've been lucky. But also I have worked damn hard for this and I've created this kind of career that I wanted around me. So that was the first thing that I thought was ace. The other thing that I thought was ace, and I tweeted about this at the time, was that there was this vibe. Obviously the audience were really engaged and there were lots of Zoe Foster-Blake fans there. But every time that Madeleine asked a question, so for instance, that kind of, can you tell us more about heartbreak, Zoe?
Yeah.
And Zoe just answered, yes, absolutely. And then went into her answer. And it struck me that it was just such a confident way to respond. And I think, do I respond like that? And I realized that what I think we do is we kind of preemptively undermine ourselves mm-hmm. often in our answers, that we do that kind of, I don't really know if this is the right answer, or I'm not the expert on this, or, you know, all those things that we do that automatically, I reckon it puts the audience on edge. It diminishes our own expertise, yeah. And I also think it kind of, it puts the audience on edge because if you're not believing yourself up there on the stage, then they're not as inclined to believe in you too.
My pet hate for someone who's giving a speech or something is for them to start by saying how much they hate public speaking.
Oh.
And how, like, that is my number one. Just
yes.
Cannot stand when people do that.
No, don't do that.
No, because it sets it up. It sets it up in a sympathy apology dynamic that is very, very difficult to shift. And you, as an audience member, have moments where you keep kind of coming out and going, they're observe the nerves. So
also, as an audience member with a tendency to anxiety, as I am. Then my anxiety is starting to ramp up. Like, what if you fall apart? And that's fine if you fall apart on stage. I'm not saying that I have an expectation that everyone is excellent on stage.
But increases the tension and the stakes somehow.
I think so too. So listening to that, I made a goal for myself that I am really going to try and answer questions in that affirmative kind of, I can answer this. I'm here for a reason. You've invited me to be here for a reason. And yes, I am going to thus answer with as best as I can right now at the time, but I'm going to own that. I'm going to own that answer. So I really like that.
Just on a random topic, one of the, my kids really like Zoe's book, the fart one. What's it called?
No One Likes a Fart.
No One Likes a Fart.
Yeah.
Great book. It is a book though, I reckon would be a great book to use in an editing class. Because I think you could halve or quarter the number of words in that book, and it would pack so much. I think it every time I read it that it's a very good book. You could
edit it down.
You could edit it down.
Controversial.
I know.
I wonder if
Who
we can
I?
Get Zoe Foster Blake to come on the First Time Podcast so we can talk
version.
To her.
But
about
it's one of the few times I've consciously thought that something could be
interesting.
Zhuzhed a bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. It is easy to do that. I find I am my best editing self when it is 7:30 and I want the kids to go to sleep and I'm reading the book and I'm like, you know
what?
Yeah, maybe
that's coming from a desire
just
for expediency.
Let's just, that word could be cut there. Catherine, what's your take on confidence?
I'm probably pretty similar. I don't think you can ever know for certain how things are going to turn out, but I am optimistic. One thing that I think the hardest thing about writing when you say haven't been published or when you're going through a period when the writing is tough and you feel like you're just getting rejected and you're sending a lot of stuff out and not getting any positive bites is the uncertainty of how things will turn out. So in a perfect world, what you could do would be to flash forward 20 years' time, meet yourself, find out that you're a published author, you've won all these awards, you've done incredibly, incredibly well, so that then when you were in the now, there would be no anxiety, despite the fact you were still experiencing rejection and all the rest of it, because you're like, I know it turns out.
I've done this already.
Like, it's totally, this is the hard, like, you would see it as a story with a positive end, and this is just the hard bit that you need to get through. Obviously, you can't do that. But I think you have to pretend is the way I think about it.
You
have to act as though you know it turns out.
That's
basically
exactly it. And I think that is, it's so hard to say. And when I was doing the mentorship with Charlotte, this was like the key learning to be a wanker that I got from the whole thing, which is no one's going to give you confidence, Kate. You have to take that confidence and you have to you have to embody it and you have to pretend, which I did at that stage because the book didn't have a deal right at that point and I was filled with anxiety about it. But what I have been so aware of and I have journaled the hell out of, thank goodness for the journal, is that as soon as I had that external validation of the book deal or even just of having an agent, there was such lightness and efficiency and confidence in the way that I could then deal with the manuscript, which was exactly the same as it was day before
I
got the deal.
Isn't it? Like, the other comment that I would make that perhaps is something you can only ever experience retrospectively is the fact that pre-publication, it seems like publication is the most important life-changing, affirming moment ever.
Yep.
And that until you, you know, maybe it's different if you write nonfiction or for different people, but until you get that, I've got a book on a shelf, that mantle of writer is hard to claim.
Yeah.
Whereas once you've been published, you realise that the neuroses are exactly the same.
Exactly. This is Tony Jordan's amazing article.
Yeah, it doesn't solve any of the problems. You are the same person, but I'm not sure if that is helpful to someone. I think you can feel that more really once.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean?
It's
sort of unfair.
And we
you can
acknowledge
keep saying that,
yes,
to someone.
We can.
But
we
it's hard
absolutely
to believe.
Acknowledge that does not feel the same for someone on the other side of publication. But confidence. You got to pretend. You got to fake it till you make it.
Yeah. And it will ebb and flow. I think that if you accept that there are waves of, you know, with higher points and lower points, then
if someone is if there's a scientist out there working on like a spray, confidence spray, you just kind of, you know, put it on like deodorant in the morning and just walk out, I'd buy that. I'd like that.
I do like that. There's a Thomas Edison quote. Thomas Edison's a very problematic person. But anyway, if you think you can, if you think you can't, you're right. So it's sort of like that kind of sums it up in some ways to me.
Totally does. It is my great pleasure to welcome Melbourne writer Alice Bishop to The First Time. Alice grew up in Christmas Hills but now lives in Thornbury, Victoria. Her first collection of short fiction, A Constant Hum, came out this year with Text Publishing. The Beginnings of a Constant Hum have been commended in the 2015 Victorian Premier's Literary Award for an unpublished manuscript, and then longlisted in both the inaugural Richelle Prize and the 2017 Kill Your Darlings Unpublished Manuscript Award. Alice's work has also appeared in Meanjin, Southerly, Australian Book Review, Griffith Review, Overland, The Suburban Review, Visible Ink, Seizure, Voiceworks, and the human rights publication Right Now. Alice, welcome to The First Time.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited about this one.
It's very lovely. And we have, I should say, we've just been chatting in this very cold Melbourne night about travels up north and how delightful it is.
Yeah, and how it's a bit of a shock to the system to come back to Melbourne.
It's such a shock. We love Melbourne, but it is a shock to the system. Yeah. Alice, I want to begin with the question, did you always want to be a writer?
I didn't. I feel like a lot of writers say that they do, but to me, I wanted to be an Olympic show jumper. Which
really?
When I was like, I loved horses growing up, and I wasn't very good at it, and my horse wasn't very kitted out with all the latest gear. But you know, my introduction to riding and reading was through, it sounds so dorky, but through horse books and nature books and stuff like that.
I love that so much. So, yeah. So when did the dream of being the Olympic show jumper kind of die?
Yeah. Pretty early on. Like I think, probably in my early teens when I used to just be bucked off my horse all the time.
Oh, and
it's a pretty brutal world, but I'm glad I got onto a different path.
So were you doing the kind of teenage poems and keeping a journal and writing at that stage,
no,
or did it come later?
It came later. It probably came when I turned I remember we read Richard Ford's Rock Springs in year 11 at Eltham High, which I know you're familiar with.
We are both alumni of Eltham High.
And I had a great teacher called Mr. Pearsall. I don't know if you had
He was after, he had my sister, but he was after my time, so I do know him.
Right.
Shout out to him.
And really he changed my life and my whole outlook, and I think teachers aren't really given enough credit for inspiring young people to do what they want to do. And I remember we read Richard Ford's work and we read Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut, and he was just encouraging, and I was a very quiet, shy, softly spoken kid, I think, who kind of would have liked to fade into the background and not actually do any creative writing, but he kind of picked me out a few times and it kind of, it made me feel like that was something I could do. So that's where it all began, really.
I love that. And do you remember, do you have a kind of vivid sense of the first time you saw your own words in print?
I do.
What was it?
Probably everyone will be familiar with Voiceworks. Yep. So I snuck in at 24 and 9 months to get my piece published in Voiceworks.
Love
because,
it.
Because the cutoff date's 25. And I remember going down to, I think it was like Mag Nation or something in the city, and with my then boyfriend, and being really, I felt really lucky, and Voiceworks, for me, I still read it. It's such a great publication, and there's a freshness to it, and it's really an important one to subscribe to, I think.
It really is, and so many people talk about getting their start there and also finding their community there.
Yeah, and editing. A lot of people get their editing start there, and I think it's a great publication.
Do you remember what was the piece?
It was called Wallpaper, and it was inspired by a more postmodern class I was taking at uni. It was the first time I ever kind of felt comfortable writing more kind of fiction in fragments.
Yep.
And I can be quite self-critical, but I reckon it was a good piece. So,
and so, Alice, did you continue then? So you were doing your master's of, is it at Melbourne?
Yeah, I did master. There was a bit of a break. So yep. I did an undergraduate degree at Melbourne Uni. Back then it was the Bachelor of Arts.
Yep.
That got me into, it was great for my brain.
Yes.
It got me into working in a chain fashion retail store.
A Bachelor of Arts does for us
for
all.
A couple of years, and I met some great, friends there. But I was a bit hungry for more, and then in 2009, obviously, what I've written a lot about in A Constant Hum, there were the bushfires of Black Saturday. Mm. And it kind of was a bit of a turning point where, in the year after that, I was thinking, after the kind of dust and ash settled a little bit, I was like, I really need to go back to uni and do what I love, which is something to do with reading and writing. And I'm very much in hex debt now still, but it was the best decision I've ever made, hands down. And I was lucky to do the Master of Creative Writing, Publishing and Editing in a time when there was Tony Birch, who was a teacher there. We did Genealogies of Place, which
wow.
I first started writing okay fiction and stuff about landscape, and that class really gave me room to move and breathe. And I think going back to uni, as much of it is, you know, it's a privilege, but really just gave me the space to read and write, and I loved it. So yeah,
I love how you talk about that, because I think so much of what we do when we're learning and when we come back and learning about writing is reading and having
totally,
those different names that come to us. And I remember just those moments where I was like, hang on a second, how did I get to be 30 years old and not read Joan Didion or whoever
know,
it was?
Like 100%.
And so there's that moment too of just being in a reading community that also really sharpens our craft, I think, as well.
And inspires so much and also gives you perspective on writers, as you said, from different parts of the world that you may never have encountered in, you know, in your kind of usual channels. And the other good thing for that is the internet, of course. You know, I've come across so many readers and writers that I admire on Twitter or on Instagram, or, you know, less so on Facebook, I guess. But it's really exciting.
So, Alice, and I want to get on to speaking about A Constant Hum, which is sitting here, and it's just the most beautiful looking book.
Isn't it? I'm very lucky that we had the beautiful cover designed by Imogen Stubbs, who's a young award-winning designer at Text. And I've just got so many comments. I feel like her name should be on the cover of the book, really.
Well, definitely next to yours, because your words are so magnificent. But it's one of those things that's like just a really precious artifact too, it feels like, to hold. And I love that, what people are doing with book design at the moment.
Yeah, it's really great.
Tell me, you said, Alice, and you've already mentioned this, A Constant Hum is based on your own and your community's experience of Black Sat Day.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that actually you went back to the writing course after that, I hadn't realised that.
Yeah.
So obviously that's really present, and the kind of aftermath as well, which is so much what your book is about. Did you start writing them immediately, or did you have to give it space and time?
So definitely space. I did start writing. We were quite practically busy for maybe 6 months, a year after the bushfires, but I think I was definitely writing in my head, as kind of cliche as that sounds. But I did a lot of writing in 2010 and 11 on a more personal kind of note, and looking back on that, it was kind of rubbish, because I think it was too the event. I mean, and all writers have different practices, and some writers can write within trauma and stuff, but for me it was too sensationalist, and I couldn't really pull back enough to get a better view, if you know what I mean. And I think even my earlier writing, when I started my thesis in 2012, which was just 15,000 words, I think my first few kind of cracks at it, it was a bit too sensationalist and raw. And and I'm definitely a writer that needs to process stuff, otherwise it doesn't come out that good.
Alice, were you talking to other writers or anyone at uni about writing through trauma at that stage? Like, was that part of your learning and your thinking at that stage?
That's a really good question. I think I didn't have any explicit conversations about it, but I think through reading people, like you mentioned Joan Didion, and, you know, the Year of Magical Thinking is obviously about the death of her husband.
I
think doing the reading and reading a lot of writers that do process trauma in such a delicate, nuanced way, you're always kind of learning from them. And I think reading is a conversation. I think it's a very much a two-way street. And writers like Josephine Rowe, who I am lucky to call a friend now, but I picked up Tuck Hard Awake and was just blown away by the how she gets into, again, the connective tissue of relationships and trauma in such a gentle but telling, and sometimes it's kind of like golden grit of it all, you know.
Yeah.
I think she's another writer I really admire. And, you know, dealing with trauma, there were a lot of workshops around the area that were doing different kind of things with people and stuff. So, you know, it was definitely on my mind, but no explicit conversations.
That's a beautiful comparison with Josephine Rowe, because I think that she and others could say exactly the same things about your own work too.
Yeah.
And that gorgeous kind of fragmentary nature of the way you've put the stories together. Is that kind of, did they lay as they kind of fell? Do you know what
no,
I mean? Like,
not
were you
at,
planning
yeah,
for that or?
Not at all. So I really looked at it at a story level in the beginning, and that's again where the beauty of a great editor comes in. I had David Winter at Text, and I think, I don't know. I couldn't, again, speaking about kind of your field of vision, I couldn't really see it as a whole thing. And David kind of said, it started off when I was in conversation with Text, it was 15,000 words, and then it went up to 90,000 words, and then it went back to, I think it's about 50,000 words now. And David said,
wow.
Yeah, said, you know, you need to have a structure throughout the book so that readers can breathe, and it needs to have some kind of through line that readers can understand, whereas before I'd had it edited, it was quite scattered. And that's another name we can add to the cover of the book, David Winter. But it was a really, you know, to use a cliche, really eye-opening for me to see how a body of work can change through an editor, you know. And I think I had in mind that I wanted to have longer stories punctuated with shorter stories, but I had no real drive to come up with an overall structure. And and kind of David said to me, why don't you break it up into three parts? I don't mind how you do it, but yeah, think about it. And I was thinking of maybe dividing it up into fire warnings, because we'd decided it would go chronologically either one way, either from 10 years before the fire up until the fire, or vice versa. And I thought fire warnings were a bit kind of ham-fisted. And then I was actually speaking to my mum, and she was like, what about wind patterns?
Mm.
And it's just a really nice thing to think that, yeah, she's a bit of a part of it, because it starts at prevailing, which is kind of the 10 years after, and the winds kind of come back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes into southerly, which is the cooler wind, which is the second section. So it's the stories are kind of getting closer to the direct aftermath of Black Saturday. And then the last section is northerly, and a lot of people will associate northerly winds with high intensity, and so that was kind of a long way of answering, in that I think a good editor can have play a big role in how the overall structure kind of pans out.
That's so interesting to hear about how it formed, because Alice, obviously there are a number of people along the way who really responded to the raw material, because your work was having all this success in unpublished manuscript awards. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of how it came to be? How text became to be the lucky ones who have published your work?
Yeah, that's, again, an interesting question. I think you go into, this is why I love listening to the first time podcast, is it's such an unknown. I think even if you're in the industry, or you're kind of coming into the industry, you're like, I don't know what a normal advance is, or what a relationship with an editor is. But so a constant hum, I had a really great supervisor at Melbourne Uni called Emmett Stinson, and he encouraged me to submit my completed first 15,000 words to the Vic Prem Awards for the Unpublished Manuscript Award. And it got commended, which I was just, blew my mind at the time. I was just so happy.
Such validation.
Yeah, too. Such validation when you're really in that murky water of not knowing if it's even worth following.
Yeah.
And then Elena from Text contacted the Wheeler Centre, where I was doing a hot desk fellowship, and said, you know, would be interested in seeing more. And I remember getting that email and just being like, oh, this is so surreal, you know.
This is it. Like, things are happening.
Oh, yeah. I'm not so naive that I thought it was in the bag. But and then it's been like a really long process from that point until mid-2018 when I signed with Text.
Yep.
So I was very much in conversation with Text about my progress. And I was in contact with David Winter, and he was very encouraging, and kind of, I guess he kind of kept an eye on the essays and stuff I was doing too. So would often message me and email me and say, you know, I saw this and how's it going? And I didn't really want to commit until if I had have had the option to commit, I would have jumped on it. But we were kind of, no one was even giving either way so much. But that was a really perfect thing, because it made me drive towards making it better and better and better and better. And I kind of saw that entering it in prizes like the Penguin Manuscript Prize, yep, and stuff would kind of add to my resume of recognition, I guess.
Yeah, it's a very impressive,
yeah,
resume of recognition.
Yeah, and so I think it was, I don't know if it was longlisted or shortlisted in the Kill Your Darlings Manuscript Prize too, and the Richelle Prize. Yeah. And I took that all as like encouragement to keep going.
Were you getting any feedback from those, like from those long listings or short listings?
I did have contact with Penguin after the short listing, and Tex contacted me after that just to kind of, you know, chat about it and stuff. But then I think there were some, I think Ben Ball was made redundant, and yeah, there was lots of movement within the publishing, yeah, industry. But to be honest, I think that those recognitions too have been real kind of guiding lights for me to keep going. And then I went to mid-year, I went to visit my then partner's family in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, and I had a month of no Wi-Fi. And it was kind of just like my race to the finish. I knew I'd set that goal to myself that I would submit to Text and to David, because they'd been asking about it a little bit, and it was like my final sprint to the finish line to get the kind of definite answer, yes or no. And luckily it was a yes.
That's fantastic. And I'm so glad that you shared that story, because so often we hear these kind of first time stories of, and then I was picked up off the slush pile, or then I did this, you know, yeah, and I got the email of my dreams. Yeah. And it's not so often that we hear what is so common,
yeah,
for so many writers, yeah, which is that you get a period of pats on the back and little bits of interest and yes, send it through, but it's just, it's not quite there
concrete,
yet. Either,
yeah,
for either of, yeah, you potentially, yeah, no one's really willing to say yes and put writing on it. So I'm really glad that you talked about that, yeah, because I think it's something that people don't often talk about. And yeah, how you said that you had to give yourself the limit to this time, I've really got to get the whole thing in.
Well, it was years of building it, I think, and years of next August I'll do it. And then it was like, oh, I could tweak a few stories and make it a little bit better. And you kind of only get, you know, one shot at it. You know, and Text was my dream publisher. Yeah. So I was like, well, I better go in with the goods, because I'll be really disappointed with myself. If they say no with my best work, that's fine. But yep, if I went in with something kind of not really up to scratch, I probably wouldn't have forgiven myself.
That's very impressive. Yeah. I want to go back to something you said earlier when you were talking about the way that you've structured the book and with those wind yep, changes, because listeners won't have heard this, but I had a little gasp of, or intake of breath, because I live in the same region as you, or my parents do. I grew up there. I now live in Hurstbridge, which is outside of that fire zone. But things like knowing that it's a northerly coming I have a physical reaction to, which I know is, yeah, what lots of your readers will have. And as I read the collection, I had the strangest sensation that there were things that you were talking about, which I know deeply and I'm very familiar with, the names of roads,
yeah,
and
wow, yeah,
the, you know, the guy who's staying at the research hotel, you know,
yeah,
like these things that have extra layers of meaning to me.
Sure.
And it struck me that this must land in such different people's hands and in their hearts, and that other people who've experienced bushfire in other parts of the world will also have visceral responses. And then, of course, the people who live in Kinglake and Christmas Hills and St Andrews and all those places that were so deeply impacted are also going to have a different reading again. Did you have that in your head as you were writing it, and or since you've been publicising it?
I think maybe more, not to use that word again, but in the aftermath.
Yeah.
I think definitely when I was kind of writing it, it was very connected to place. And I write so much about Christmas Hills and Hurstbridge, you know, that's just next door.
Yeah.
And that's really surreal. But I think I wanted to really kind of write about that place because it's the place I love and know. But it's only since kind of neighbours and people have been contacting kind of afterwards that I've realised that it does have that kind of visceral feeling for people, you know. And I hope it does translate to people who come from other areas, and I guess it kind of has already. But I think that's so cool that you kind of recognize, yeah, you know, the research hotel. Yeah,
and absolutely. What kinds of responses are you getting from people, and how are, yeah, people getting in contact with you? Because that could be really overwhelming too, I imagine.
I was worried it would be more overwhelming than it has been, to be honest. And yeah, I think you kind of get different audiences. There was a review in the Herald Sun, brilliantly titled Valley Girl. Very Herald Sun. But, you know, it was nice. I was having like a pie down the street in Yarra Glen with my dad, and these two kind of like older vineyard workers came up, and they knew Dad through some work that he'd done out in the valley. And they were like, oh, you wrote that book. And I was like, yeah. And they're like, oh, I'm definitely going to get a copy. And then you have different people like our neighbours, Libby and Claire, who lost their house next door to us. And you know, they've started texting my dad photos of their burnt down house and said that the book made them cry, I hope in a good way. Yeah. But, you know, it's good to open conversations and stuff. But then also, you know, when I was in Alice Springs for the Northern Territory Writers Festival, surprisingly, a couple of women came up to me, you know, after my session there and said, you know, I moved up to Alice Springs because there's no crowns to catch light up here.
Wow.
And, you know, and to me, that's something that I forget, that even though we maybe those fires were confined to a very, I mean, there was a lot of acres burned, but it's had such a ripple effect throughout communities that, you know, people all across Australia, maybe even overseas, have memories and very visceral memories of that day.
This year marked the 10-year anniversary of the Black Saturday fires. And Alice, during that time, you shared all of these extraordinary images and words on your Instagram feed. And they were images of items that you had found in the rubble after your house was destroyed. What was really extraordinary is that as I was reading A Constant Hum, I kind of had those images in my head, and it really felt to me like it had been this kind of intimate little preamble to your book. And I was just wondering about the experience of having so many images, kind of having so much content out in the world about those fires, how you kind of hold that all together. What is yours and what is private? What is personal? What is the collective memory of that experience too?
That's a good question. I often, when I'm talking about A Constant Hum, kind of preface it with, we all survived. Mm. And that is a really big thing to remember, because I don't know if I could be, you know, publicizing this book or talking about Black Saturday in a way that I do if I had have lost my mum or my dad or my brother or my sister. And so many people, as you know, in the community lost people. But for me, in regards to sharing items from the house after it burnt down, we used to have a crate in the shed, in the rebuilt shed, of kind of, I guess, just found objects from in the ash. And mum will kill me for saying this, but I'd kind of wanted to do a little profile essay of all the pieces of left behind. And I remember maybe 2 days before, the week before the anniversary, the decade anniversary, I was like, hey mum, do you know where that big crate of ashy stuff is? And she was like, oh, why? And some of the stuff in there was really important. It was, you know, bits of broken porcelain and you know, the kind of ceramic leg of a childhood horse and stuff. Yeah. And she was like, oh, I'm so sorry, I just had to get rid of it.
Wow.
But at the same time, it was like, I totally understand that need to rid your kind of life of those remnants. And for me, that kind of made me think about, how was this my story necessarily to be telling so much? And it is a constant question that you have to kind of renegotiate or open up conversations with people, I think. I think I wanted to do the kind of, I did scrounge together 5 or 6 items that I found in the garden, and we have the melted wombat, the ceramic wombat, which is still on our deck. And there's a little bit of chipped porcelain from one of mum's good sets that we found in the dirt anyway. But I think it kind of links back to the writing that I love, that it's those little bits of story that make up the bigger story, and that they're the ones that can kind of thump you in the chest the most. Mm. Mum will be horrified that I'm retelling the story because she felt so bad. But, you know, everyone deals with trauma and bushfire and disaster in different ways. And I hope A Constant Hum kind of shows that a little bit.
I think that it really does. I think that's one of the beautiful things, and you do it so gently, is to show that the experience is very different for different people.
Thank you.
And I think that you show that with deep compassion. I wanted to ask you about some of the other writing that you've done as well, because I reread your essay Coppering, which was shortlisted in the 2017 Horn Prize. And I read it at the time, but I reread it again this week. I had an enormous weep as I was reading it. We'll link to it so everyone else can have an enormous weep as well. But I think that it is pitch perfect. It's about the bushfires. It explores regrowth. It also explores the experience of living with an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about the writing process for that essay and how it sits differently to maybe how you do your fiction?
I've been really lucky to have a good working relationship with Jonathan Green from Me Engine.
That's a great relationship to have.
I'll keep that one close.
Yeah.
He's a lovely guy. And for some reason, and sometimes I wonder if it's gendered, I'm not sure if it is, but I never really thought I could write nonfiction. And Jonathan contacted me about writing. I wrote an essay called Heroic Men and Helpful Women, which was about the kind of gendered expectations on men and women after bushfire. And then I was lucky enough to, there was a Christmas Hills Writers Festival, believe it or not.
Yes, I know about the Christmas Hills Writers Festival.
And I was lucky to drive Tony Birch out, and he was talking a lot about, you know, writing. We're talking about books we loved. He's also a huge fan of Josephine Rowe, it turns out. And he ended up writing a essay called, I think it's called Ten Fires. Okay. I could be wrong, but it's in Meanjin. And he had this connection with my dad and wrote about that in amongst lots of other stuff about kind of Indigenous issues and land management. And he was writing a lot about Banff and issues over there.
Yep.
And he was writing about that, but then laced throughout the essay was kind of his interactions with my dad, and they kind of clicked a lot, I guess. And I was thinking about my dad, and it sounds twee, but I was thinking about how he really is a good guy. And I was like, oh, well, I should write about, you know, my experience with my dad. And I'll always remember, and the kind of the key image for me that sparked that essay was a few months after the fire, we were standing kind of where the house used to be, and as you've read the essay, you'll know where I'm going. And I'd been very sick with different kind of eating disorders from probably like 16 until 21. And Dad was like, "Oh, I'd rather have this house burned down over and over again than you ever get sick again."
That's a bit, I'm just having a little moment, because that's the bit that makes me cry. No, keep, please keep going. Second time I've cried on the podcast.
And to me, I thought I could use that image, and because I got out of Melbourne Clinic, which from the eating disorder unit in 2008, exactly a year before the house burnt down. And I thought I could mirror the bush growing back with essentially my body growing back, and that's what I did in Coppering. And it for some reason it was quite quick to write, and I'm not a quick writer, but I think I'd been so scared to write about eating disorders. And I remember the brilliant Fiona Wright's book came out, Small Acts of Disappearance, and I was so scared to pick it up for so long. And then I was one of those like fan writers. I messaged her on Twitter and I was like, thank you so much. I never used to be able to say the word bulimia out loud because I was so ashamed. And that kind of sparked it too, in that I was like, wow, you can write about eating disorders in a way that's not sensationalist or triggering or, you know. The last book I'd read on eating disorders before Fiona Wright's was Portia de Rossi's biography, which, you know, there's a place for everything. But that, for me, I was almost reading it for tips rather than for theory or for, you know, a kind of broader outlook on it all. So I definitely want to write more nonfiction. I don't want any more life trauma to have to draw, draw on.
Please
but,
not.
But, I think creative nonfiction is just such a beautiful vehicle for finding out more about yourself and others, I think.
How did you feel? That's a wonderful and generous answer. Thank you. How did it feel coming out in the world? Did you feel raw, nervous, relieved? Mm. Like, was it a different experience than when your other work had been out?
I think I've been healthy for so long that it wasn't as scary. And I think people like Fiona Wright have just been trailblazers for so much other work that's coming out in so many different ways. That's not to say I wasn't nervous, because I think a big part of mental illness and eating disorders is shame. Mm. But, you know, I'm 33 now and that was a long time ago. So I think, yet again, the distance had given me space to write about it. I had written about it from hospital, and I think, again, it was too raw and too sensationalist. And I guess it was writing for a very different purpose. Mm. And I think it's really important for younger writers and stuff to only write about stuff and put it out in the world if you're really comfortable with that, because I think sometimes it could be damaging.
That's really wonderful advice. There was a great interview on the Garrett podcast. Astrid was interviewing Marit Carty, talking about having people come to festivals and times where she said, I'm not going to have that person in the festival because I don't want kind of them to be at risk. Like that story has come out, and maybe they're not ready to talk about it yet. So that's great advice that you're giving to young writers.
Yeah, and I guess it's such a personal thing. Absolutely. It's hard to make a call for someone else maybe, but also, it can put you in a very difficult situation, especially if you feel like you need to build your brand or your writing career on something that's going to be detrimental to you.
I want to ask you that too, because we talk so often to writers about that narrative that is built around their author persona at the same time as they've got a book out in the world. So much of your writing has focused at this point on Black Saturday and the aftermath of that.
Yeah.
Is it kind of a physical letting go process for you to move on to what's ahead for you, the next projects?
It's kind of scary. You know, I've been working on this for years and years and years, but it's also exciting. Like, I feel like, I don't know, I'm happy to let it go.
Yeah. I can see that would be and a way for it to come out kind of so beautifully as a thing, as an object that can come out.
And I think, you know, to bring my family into it, I remember we were watching the footage. There was actually some really beautiful ABC documentaries about the 10-year anniversary of Black Saturday. Some amazing journalism pieces too, and you know, photos and reportage. And I remember we watched the 10-year anniversary documentary, and Mum kind of cried at the part where there was the singed cat, because she went back for a long time looking for our cat, even though it was clearly gone. And then we were having dinner that night, and she was just like, oh, thank God that's over. Let's not talk about it anymore. I'm so sick of talking about the fires. Yeah. So I kind of, there's a bit of an element of that too, of just like, oh, it's done. But I'm also in such a good place that I don't mind talking about it either. Yeah. Maybe if it was 8 years ago or 6 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to do what I'm doing now.
Yeah. I feel like I'm in a special place with inside information, because I know that your family has rebuilt in Christmas Hills. So I just want the listeners to know that too, because I feel like they'll be sitting on the edge of their thing going, what did they go back? Can you tell us what is the experience like now for you being there?
Oh, it's great. I love, like, I feel, again, it's important to note that that's not the one and only way to deal with bushfire.
Absolutely.
A lot of people need to move interstate. Some people need to move overseas. There were concerns of going back, obviously, and we have a fire bunker now. And, you know, there are difficult conversations that we continue to have. But it's my favourite place in the world, you know. Like, I was there, I came from there today, and there was a wedge-tailed eagle kind of flying across the valley. We saw wombats last night, and to see all those animals, you know, bushfire is such a normal part of the Australian bush. Maybe not the firestorms of Black Saturday, because they were so intense, but to see everything come back has been such a privilege and a pleasure. And it's really changed my kind of perspective on the world, seeing everything go and disappear and what the end of the world would look like, and then seeing it still come back. You know, it's a really good life lesson.
Alice, like, you mentioned this already, your Hot Desk Fellowship, and some of our other guests, Khalid Wasame, Rajith Savanadasa, Jamie Marina Lau, have all been...
It's an impressive list.
Yeah, it's a great list, and you're on it too, that have been Hot Desk Fellows. How did that assist in your writing, being there?
To be really frank, I don't know if I produced that much while I was there, but it was like it gave me that stamp of approval that my writing was valid. Mm. And I wrote actually one story in the collection, Flight Path, which is about the Yarra Glen racetrack. Mm. And that went up on the Wheeler Centre online, and that was part of that kind of validation that made me realise that it was something worth pursuing, and that I wasn't kind of kidding myself. And being in such a great environment like the Wheeler Centre, where there's, I think, VoiceWorks offices in there and Australian poetry, it just gives you so much hope, and that we are so lucky in Melbourne for having such a great literary culture.
Yeah, we really are. Yeah. And everywhere else is lucky too, but we're particularly lucky. I was looking through some interviews with you, and I really loved one that you did with the Suburban Review in 2015. And you talked about the fact that you only got into the fellowship the second time. Yep. And if you don't mind me quoting you back to yourself, you said, like most things in the literary and broader world, you often have to take rejection in your stride and keep going. As cliches as it sounds, it does make you stronger. Can you tell us about how you've dealt with rejection in your writing life?
It's one of my favourite topics, rejection. to kind of overshare, I'm online dating at the moment, and I think... I think rejection in terms of writing pales in comparison, so I'm like an expert at it now. But I have sold a few books on Tinder, actually, which is a whole other essay on itself.
Oh, that is so impressive. Oh, can you please write that essay?
Yeah, I think I am going to. But I think rejection, you know, when I think about, so there's one story in A Constant Hum called Sticks, which is about, it's got a younger narrator, and it's about her friend being obsessed in primary school of rebuilding their burnt down house with paddle pop sticks and the snack packets and stuff. And that was rejected by Kill Your Darlings and Lifted Brow and many other publications. And then it won the Lord Mayor's Prize in 2017. And it's been one of the I'm definitely one for editing after rejection to make things better, but I did not change a single word. And it's been one that a lot of people comment on. You know, they say that it's a really kind of affecting story. And I think that in itself is such good evidence that, you know, you can't be everyone's cup of tea, and that's okay.
So true. Yeah. Alice, how did you hold on to your belief in that story and not let those rejections get to you?
Well, I mean, I have my moments like anyone, you know, you go, oh, maybe it is kind of crap and maybe I've missed the mark. And I think it's important not to just take things blindly and be like, no, this story is good and it's going to get published. Mm. I don't know the answer to that, to be honest. I think it felt that there was an essence of truth in it somewhere. And I have a few friends who are, you know, who are readers who generously kind of tap into my work sometimes, and one friend had really liked it, and I guess you just kind of persist and chuck stuff out in the world as much as possible if you've spent time on it, of course, and if you've put it in a drawer and come back to it and it still reads half decent. But I think that's a pretty good example of how journals have specific tastes and
at different times some people at some journal, you know, and it didn't get picked up by that right person on that right day.
Yeah. So my old friend and I, we used to look at our kind of, is it submittable?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we'll rack up our submittable kind of rejections and you get a lot, but at the same time you learn how to kind of stop caring as much about it, I guess. I got my first one star Goodreads review the other day. But you know what? It was kind of liberating to be like, I really don't really care.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have to find those ways. You'll have to come next year too. I'm pretty sure that Writers Vic will host
someone
their,
tweeted that at me.
Yeah, Starry Night again, because I do think that there is a way that we have to hold those lightly as well. And sometimes you feel like you can do that really well and they don't knock you down at all.
And other times they can be soul destroying.
Sometimes they really can.
Yeah.
You talked then about a couple of people who are readers for you and you've mentioned various kind of people like Jonathan Green, Tony Birch, who are mentors at different ways. What is your wider kind of writer network, and how and in what ways do they support you? In what different ways, maybe?
That's a good question. I lived with Laura McPhee Brown for a while, who's a beautiful writer, and I think we had a really good relationship. She's got a book coming out with Tex soon, actually, called Cherry Beach, which will be beautiful.
Exciting.
Yeah. And we kind of lived together and, encouraged each other while we were both, the normal ups and downs of being a writer.
And shared each other's work. I find that so interesting that
definitely.
You lived together and could do that. Yeah,
and, I think I'm really lucky. I'm friends with Josephine Rowe, who's a writer that I absolutely admire, and it's nice because she's a bit more experienced than me, and to kind of know what's normal with the publishing industry and the kind of how to ride those kind of waves of not knowing how many books you've sold or what's the normal advance and just the waiting, I think the waiting. Endless waiting and how to kind of sit with that a bit better. Has been something that I've had to learn to do, which probably most people have had to learn to do.
But also to be able to work in that state as
that's
well.
True. That's
a really, difficult state to work in, I think.
That's a really, But again, I think when I think about the writing community in Melbourne, I think about the smaller journals too, like the Suburban Review, where I had a piece published, and all those ones kind of that build your confidence, but also expose you to writing that is really inspiring. Mm. And I sound like a broken record, but we're just so lucky to live here.
Yeah, we really are. In that same Suburban Review interview, you said that you consider yourself a quieter feminist. and you mentioned a fantastic quote from, now I'm just looking at it and going, is it Deborah
Levitt? I don't even know. Levy? I don't know if you say Levi. I say it different in every context. It's Levi, or I think it's Levi.
Okay. You know who we're talking about. She's amazing. She's brilliant. I'm a massive fan. Yeah. Her quote is, "To become a writer, I had to learn to interrupt, to speak up, to speak a little louder, and then to just speak in my own voice, which is not loud at all." Mm. What advice do you give to writers who feel like they haven't yet learnt to interrupt or to speak up or to speak in their own voice?
That's a good question. I think I probably stayed quiet through all my uni shoots. Because I was maybe didn't have the confidence, or I was a bit anxious and going through personal stuff. But I really wish I'd used those opportunities more to have more of a conversation with people about writing and to share more of my work. But I think it all kind of comes down, and I'm kind of probably going to personalize this, but it's more of not being so attuned to the white noise of everything that's going on around you and everyone else's voices about that you imagine, are telling you what you should write or what you should read. And I think you kind of just have to hone into what, it sounds so cliche, but write what you know, and what you care about. And sure, I've written, when I was younger, I wrote about heartbreak and all of that stuff, and I've done that in a constant hum, but I was doing it in a way that I thought I should be writing about it, and it ended up not being true. And I think it just takes time, and it takes practice, and it takes a lot of reading. And I think it's okay to be quiet as well, and that's something that's taken me probably 30 years to realize that you know there's strength in that as well. And that's why I loved that quote so much.
It's a beautiful quote, and that's beautiful advice that you have given to our listeners as well. Before I let you go, Alice, I want to ask you, can you recommend to us another debut book?
Yes. Well, can I go back to Josephine Rowe yet again?
Yes, you totally can.
she has this really small cream book called East of Here, Close to Water. And I think you can get it at select places, but maybe libraries are the best bet. But it's, I think, one of her first ones, and it's kind of illustrated with black and white drawings. And it's flash fiction, probably before that term was kind of really kind of mainstream, and it really just kicks you in the guts in the best way.
That's the best kind of book, as does yours. And I want to thank you so much. I've got two copies here. I've got one to be signed for me and one on a personal note for my mum and dad, who are members of a fire brigade out in Christmas Hills.
So amazing.
And
surreal.
I know. And I just think that it's such a joy to have this book out in the world. Mm. And thank you for writing
it. Thank you. And thank you for your podcast. It keeps me going on long office days when I'm losing hope.
Well, thank you for joining us on it.
Thanks, Kate.
Thanks so much, Alice. So, Alice Bishop, you're brave enough to answer our first time quick five. Remember, you're allowed to pass on any question. For your first time, agented or unagented?
Unagented.
Advance or no advance?
Advance.
Overseas territories or just Australia, New Zealand?
I think just Australia.
Watch this space. Festival invites or no festival invites?
Yes, I went to the brilliant Northern Territory Writers Festival, which I think it alternates between Alice Springs and Darwin.
Your pictures looked so amazing.
I think it's curated by Danny Powell, who's just did it in such a respectful, authentic way. Everyone should go. It was just surreal.
I'm very, very keen. Mm. It's on my list. Fantastic. You don't know how many copies you've sold yet because it is just out in the world.
I recommend,
yes, everyone go out and buy a copy so that Alice isn't scared to find out her results.
Thanks, Thank Kate. You. Thank you.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first and second time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Ady. The First Time Podcast is supported by Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, RMIT School of Media and Communication, and by our wonderful supporters on Patreon. You too can become a supporter of our podcast by heading to our Patreon site, www.patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.